Hello, I'm Steve Ruggieri, and this is Colonel Elvin Baker, and he's here with us today to share his experiences about Vietnam. He was born in Ohio in 1932, and he worked in the branch of the Army, and he retired with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel.
Okay, first off, what did you do before you joined the Army?
Worked in a machine shop as a young trainee.
Okay, and what encouraged you to join the Army?
I didn't have a choice. I was drafted in 1952.
Okay, did anyone in your family serve in the Army beforehand?
No.
Okay, so at what age did you join?
About 19 and a half when I was drafted.
Did you consider any other branches of the military?
You really didn't have a choice. You know, okay. The Army needed the people most, and that's where you went.
Okay, so you flew helicopters?
Right, but that came later. Initially, I was a field artillery person, trained that way, but I was kind of a guy that volunteered for everything. So the first year I got a commission, the second year I applied for flight school and became one of the early Army aviators.
Okay, so you decided to do that. That was your idea.
Yes, my high school ambition was to be, according to the yearbook, was to be an airline pilot. That's the next best thing.
So what special training did you need to fly helicopters?
First, I was a fixed-wing pilot. That's not true anymore. They often train directly in the helicopter, but at that time, you normally started in fixed-wing, and I flew that for 6 years, and then the Army considered me for helicopter school, and I went to helicopter school in Mineral Wells, Texas.
Is that because helicopters are more difficult to fly?
Not necessarily.
Okay. How did you adjust to military life?
By the rank I attained in 20 years, I thought I did very well. Okay. I accepted it, volunteered for all challenges, and was successful in all of them.
So at what time did you go to Vietnam?
It was 1966, which was sort of a shock because I had been in the U.S. and went the other way to Europe with my family in 1965. 9 months later, I get a 5-day alert to get my family and myself back to the United States to prepare to go to Vietnam.
So how did you feel when it was announced that the United States was going to war?
That's a soldier's duty. You do what the nation needs you to do. Your country asks you to go, and you don't question that, you go.
Okay, so how was it arriving in Vietnam?
Well, that was quite an experience, arriving by ship and being dumped out at a harbor with very new and crude facilities and no place for us to live. So we began to build a place to live, which interfered with the mission somewhat, but it was necessary.
Did you initially start flying helicopters?
We did, but only really in training to prepare, the unit for, because it was a brand new unit, formed in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, went over there, got our aircraft in country, in Vietnam, and then began to train as a unit, yes.
So what time?
Several months before I actually did any combat missions.
So what type of aircraft did you fly?
The UH-1, the Huey, commonly known as the Huey.
Was that that was brand new then?
They were mostly brand new turbine-powered helicopters, the latest thing the Army had.
So what did you actually, what was your job in the helicopter itself?
Once we got to Vietnam, they kind of split us up, and I became the executive officer, number two guy in the company.
Okay. Were you in actual combat while flying the helicopters, or did you mostly transport soldiers?
A lot of both. I did not do a lot of combat missions because of the rank and the fact that I ran the home camp, the home airfield, and I was in charge of building the camp. But we were always short of pilots, so they would call me in the middle of the night to be there for a operation the next day, or that evening they'd call me during the day for a night mission. It was always never know what's going to happen the next day. And we evacuated civilians, children, wounded adults, plague victims, all kinds of disease. We performed a humanitarian mission as well as fought a war.
So you weren't, were you near the front line?
Well, the front line, you were in the middle of everything. You're in the middle of everything. You know, this was a war so quite like the one in Iraq right now, or Afghanistan, where the enemy is all around you, and you're not sure who the enemy really is.
And on that note, what did you think of the Viet Cong?
Well, basically they were a desperate young communist group that wanted control of the country. And they had a very rough life. We had them beat by the end of the war, but we weren't allowed to finish it.
So how did you cope with the action that you witnessed?
Well, war is hell, there's no question about that. And the human sacrifices made, you know, were bad. But we were a very experienced group that went over there, and we did not have a single casualty the whole year. The only person we lost was one pilot who had extended after a normal tour. So we were quite proud of that.
You didn't actually, the helicopters weren't actually fired at. You didn't crash any helicopters.
I only came home with one bullet hole in my helicopter. Okay. I'm not exactly sure where that happened.
The Tet Offensive was considered to be one of the larger turning points in the war. Were you involved with that, and how did you feel about it?
No, the Tet Offensive was after I left the country. That was a war that the U.S. media announced that we lost, but we actually won by all accounts, including General Giap, the North Vietnamese general, who said that, you know, the Viet Cong were finished after that battle. But the U.S. press saw it as a different story. We lost. That's disturbing.
So, do you think it was premature for the United States to leave Vietnam?
Yes. If you dig out General Giap's book and read his story, they were really ready to, you know, accept defeat at that point. But the anti-war protesters and the media gave them enough encouragement to continue the fight.
The Vietnam was considered one of the harder wars to fight. It was very difficult because of the dense jungle environments. Do you think that flying helicopters was an instrumental part in fighting the war?
I definitely do, because of the lack of roads. There just wasn't much infrastructure except around the big cities. Yeah, the rest of the country was had a very broken down highway that connected the bigger cities. So in between, some type of aircraft was necessary. And because of the lack of airfield, the helicopter provided the perfect solution. They were new, you know, we didn't really have that well-protected aircraft, but still they did a very good job. Early ones were even struck by bows and arrows. The weapons were that primitive. But of course, then they got North Vietnamese, Russian missiles, and shoulder-fired missiles. These didn't occur until later on in the war, but it became a pretty bloody mess after that.
Did the helicopter technology advance, or did you use the same helicopter like primarily during the whole war?
No, I didn't use the same aircraft. I used what we had available that day. We scheduled as many as we could. Of course, you rotate them through a maintenance cycle, repair them, and inspect them, that sort of thing.
So you flew the Huey. The Huey was used throughout the whole war, then?
Yes. I flew about four different models over there.
Okay. To kind of like deal with the jungle environment, the United States used a lot of new technology like napalm and Agent Orange. How did you feel about this?
Yeah, I think Agent Orange was used without enough research and proved to really be a very bad long-term thing to do. You know, chemical warfare has its place, but I think this was pressed into service without adequate study. We also used a dioxin-containing agent on the roads to cut down on dust, because the dust was so bad it caused a lot of respiratory problems. And then, of course, then this proved to be a bad decision too.
Do you think, despite the drawbacks, do you think they were helpful?
It denied the enemy a place to hide. It really worked. the railroads began to operate because we cleared the brush on the jungle on both sides of the railroad tracks where they used to hide. It had a very positive effect, but the long-term effect was not good.
So do you believe that it should have been used in the first place?
I think it was a necessary thing to do at the time. It's too bad they didn't know more about the residual effects of the chemical, but it did save American lives.
So a lot of films have been based off Vietnam, like most notably Full Metal Jacket, 4th of July, We Were Soldiers. Have you seen any movies based off Vietnam? Do you think that they depict the war accurately?
I really can't say because I haven't watched them. I saw one John Wayne movie on the war, and I don't remember the title of it.
So you haven't seen Forrest Gump by any chance?
No.
Did you form any friendships while in service?
Only members of the unit. We didn't make any outside friends.
So did you keep up with anyone that you met in the unit through, veteran organizations?
No, I've really lost. I've lost track of all of them.
Okay. During the war, were you able to pursue any like off-duty activities?
No, there was no time. You're fighting 24 hours a day. Or you got to be ready to anyway, 7 days a week. So there's not much recreation time.
You said before that you had to notify your family that you were leaving and you had to get back to the States. Were you able to keep in contact with your family while in the war?
Oh yes, while en route, you know, actually we packed up in the country and brought the wife and the three children out together. We all flew back together. Once in the U.S., then we formed, you know, I had to leave and form a new unit.
So your family was actually, was nearby then?
We had a home in Ohio.
Oh, okay. Where were you when the war ended?
I believe I was still teaching ROTC at Akron University, which was my last assignment in the Army.
Did you return to Vietnam after it was declared over? Or would you just stay stateside the whole time?
No, I never went back. Stayed stateside.
When you returned home, how were you received by your family and community?
I had no problem with the family and being from a rural setting in Ohio. I even got up and spoke in church. You know, I said, support the thing. Don't let it die.
So how are you received by your family and community?
I never really had any problem with the family or community because of the rural Ohio setting. But while teaching ROTC at Akron, I lived about 4 miles from the Kent State campus, which is a very liberal school, and saw a lot of their problems. I saw a good friend lose 30 years of memorabilia when they burned his office down. And of course, I was present during the war with the National Guard, which was unfortunate, but it was festering and just came to head and people got hurt.
Talking about that, there was a lot of counterculture hippie movements. I mean, what did you feel about all that?
I thought it was very unpatriotic behavior, period. Unreasonable behavior. And we had a small contingent, but very small, at Akron U. We used to allow them to march behind our troops in ROTC parades. You know, they'd chant and so forth, but we'd drown them out with music and normal cadence calling.
So in that case, you think it was completely unnecessary?
Yes.
Do you think that, I mean, even though you saw it as inappropriate, do you think that it still helps, I mean, draw the war to an end?
Do it to an end, but an unfortunate conclusion. And I respect the right of people to protest, but they have to realize that in the process of protesting, they're supporting the enemy very definitely, because soldiers fight on morale.
Okay, so how did you feel about draft dodgers?
Well, as long as I recognize as such, they just didn't do their duty. You know, they shirked their duty, but that's fine. It was their choice.
Do you think that it was the war would have been a lot different if there had not been a draft?
No, I don't think it would have changed a thing.
So you still would have volunteered, though?
I would have if I was needed, yes. Mm-hmm.
What What did you do after you went stateside?
I came back and ran a survival training school, including mock POW camps where you learn how to treat people and also how to survive under the Asiatic abuse that they tend to pound on our people. And then went off to teach ROTC, and then retired.
And that you retired as a lieutenant colonel.
What?
Sorry, you retired. Did you earn the rank of colonel while you were stateside?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
After you retired, how did you adjust to civilian life?
Well, I had no problems. I couldn't find a flying job because I retired in Akron, and the rubber industry was in the doldrums. So I got involved in the automobile industry in Detroit, and had no problems adjusting.
How has your experience in Vietnam affected your life?
Really none. I have no effects, you know. And I don't always understand some of the people who do, you know, have lived such broken lives. I don't understand it really. But, because to me it was a job, you did the job, and you came home and continued to do what you believed in.
Did you learn anything while in Vietnam? I mean, did you draw anything from the experience?
Nothing really special. Just continued my education, you know, in flying and being a soldier.
So really, it was just like any other job.
Just like any other job, right.
I mean, earlier you were talking about how there's similarities between the Vietnam and Iraqi wars. Do you think that with the Vietnamization programs, and do you think that the two wars have a lot of similarities?
They do. It's just the American people at least respect the soldiers and welcome them back without spitting on them, which is a very good thing.
Have you ever visited the Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
No, I haven't been there.
What advice would you give anyone who's volunteering for the Army now?
I think it offers lots of opportunity. I got my education. I spent 14 years at night school and finally got 6 months in residency to finish my degree. So to me, it was just, and I learned to fly and flew many different types of aircraft and helicopters. I think it's a very rewarding and enlightening career.
In 1985, Richard Nixon said that no event in American history is more misunderstood than the Vietnam War. It was misinterpreted then and is misremembered now. Would you agree with Mr. Nixon?
I do, and the same thing is occurring right now today. And we commit ourselves to free a country, we need to fight it to the end. And 100% participation would really help.
The Vietnam War was still the longest modern American war, but you still think that it should have been brought to an end?
It could have been brought to an end much sooner if it exerted the effort from the beginning, but it was done in a piecemeal fashion so as not to upset the country and the economy and all that sort of thing. And it ended up, you know, it becomes more costly in terms of money and lives than really necessary. If you're going to go to war, you have to commit yourself 100% to that job of winning the war. Don't just play around and shoot around. The Vietnam War was also fought with one hand tied behind her back because we couldn't bomb Haiphong Harbor, where all the Russian ships were bringing in missiles, the most elaborate anti-aircraft missile system that ever set up was in North Vietnam, supplied totally by the Russians.
Were you really committed to the anti-communist cause for the war?
Not really, no. People can feel the way they want to feel, you know. Their type of government is not that important to me.
But how did you feel about? I mean, because America was forced to to get out of Vietnam. How did you feel when you saw that North Vietnam took over South Vietnam after all you had done?
Well, it just proved the reason we went there in the first place was to stop that, to avoid it. And we're not allowed to be successful because we support was withdrawn and we just withdrew. The South Vietnamese really were not that motivated, though. They were very laid-back, easygoing people, peace-loving people. It was often difficult to get them to fight as soldiers, even, because they were just that gentle, laid-back type of person. While the North Vietnamese were very well indoctrinated, very well controlled by a strong communist government, who beat it in their heads, you got to win this war. It's sad that they got trampled, this poor Southern Vietnamese.
So in that case, you definitely think that the North Vietnam were much more superior fighting force?
Oh, yes. Because of their determination and the strong central leadership, which the people really didn't have a choice. They followed the leader or they got shot in the back.
Now with email and internet, it's much easier to keep in contact with family members if you're in the army. Wasn't difficult to keep in contact then?
Not too bad. So we got very good mail service between Vietnam and the U.S. I even bought tools and had them shipped over. Electric saw that we didn't have in the unit. And we're building the barracks tent frames for our tents to make it more livable. And the Army didn't have one, so we just ordered one from Sears Roebuck. And it was there in about 5 days.
Where were you stationed in Vietnam?
At a very small Special Forces camp around which we built the base of Dong Vo Thin, including an airfield. We improved the airfield.
Right now, John McCain is running for president, and he's using his POW and experience in Vietnam as a kind of to help him along with the campaign. Do you think that would cause a lot of veterans to vote for him?
I think yes, because he didn't surrender to the enemy. He was shot down out of the sky and dragged out of the water with broken bones. And the fact that he survived 5 years of very rough treatment, I think only makes him a tougher guy.
So what are you most proud of?
That I survived 20 years of it without any injuries.
So would you do it again?
Absolutely. That's another thing that bothered me about American people too. They think everything should be solved in the length of a TV episode. 1 or 2 hours and you should be able to finish the whole thing. That's not the way the real world happens, you know. It takes time.
Takes effort.
They complain about the length of the Iraqi war, and yet it's more of an occupation. We had an occupation in Germany that didn't end until the first year I was over there, 1954. You know, from 45 to 54, 9 years we were occupiers. Our license plate said U.S. Occupation Forces.
Were you in the Korean Wars?
Not in the shooting war. I was drafted for the Korean War, but I didn't get over there. They sent me to Europe. And I got there at the end of the occupation. Of course, the German people were, not so divided. They're much more organized. Not as chaotic a situation as Iraq. I'm sure there was hostilities when the occupation forces first took over. The thing that does intrigue me, though, is that, like Kent State, that we knew that there's a group of people, SDS type, they're radical students who didn't go to school, who were well financed by someone. They stayed in a nice motel, drove expensive cars, and they would come around town and incite these things. And this was given to me by word of mouth from a retired Air Force person who had his office in one of these motels. He ran insurance bills. And he saw it happen repeatedly. It wasn't once. Repeatedly, and yet our government has never identified this, situation, either because they that don't want people to know they were spying on them, and that's not nice. But they were subversive people who should have been, you know, pinpointed and hung up by their heels. Because a lot of the kids at Kent State got killed because of them. They provoked something and then left town before the first person was arrested or shot at. Went on to start another one.
The people financing the students.
The people doing, actually out there on the ground doing it. We don't know who the finance, you know, the source of money was.
Do you think the fact that four students were actually killed, do you think that could have been easily averted?
If these people had been stopped, you know, the inciters of these riots that were happening all over the United States in campuses, at school campuses, yes, they would have been spared. But we, in the interest of freedom of speech and all this sort of thing, these guys, you know, ran wild around the country, burning and trashing one thing after another.
All right. You were talking about earlier how you were issued weapons that were actually very old and not up to date to the.
Yes, yes. We never got the M16 in Vietnam, in our unit. Our unit. The unit that had arrived the year before came with the weapons. When the supply ran out, they started issuing the older, obsolete weapons. And the pilots were carrying 45s, which are much heavier and more a bulkier weapon than the new 38s that they issued until they ran out. So it's the old thing, you know, we go into every war unprepared because of money, lack of preparation. And people get hurt because of it. And that's a shame.
So the pilots generally get older weapons, opposed to the front line?
Yes, yes. But until they ran out, you know, the year before probably, the pilots were getting the newer weapons, like the Air Force had, the 38 pistol, or 38 revolvers, actually. And we had a 1911 45 caliber pistol. You could throw at somebody and probably do more damage than shooting them. Very heavy.
So how did you feel about Richard Nixon ordering troops to go into Cambodia?
I thought it was overdue. You know, it's it's a crazy way to fight a war with one hand tied behind your back and allow the enemy, because some arbitrary border, to be stockpiling weapons and hiding out just across the border, able to sneak through and attack you and supply the troops fighting you, and you can't go over there and zap them. You know, that's causes unnecessary casualties on our side and prolongs the war. If they just closed Haiphong Harbor, it would have stopped a lot of things, like McCain being shot down with a Russian missile. But we didn't want to, you know, get the Russians disturbed. They might join in the war.
So,
I know why, but you know, it doesn't make sense, and it gets people killed.
So you're talking about this Haiphong Harbor. Was that North Viet Cong control?
North Vietnam, yeah. See, the North the Viet Cong were the really the Southerners who were the underground army. And backed up by the North Vietnamese. It really didn't get too bloody until the North Vietnamese moved in and brought all their more modern Russian weapons. It got really nasty.
Well, a lot of the fighting was guerrilla warfare and hit and run. Did you witness a lot of like traps, and because there's supposed to have been traps set up for, you know, soldiers? And
I saw some, yes, and they. The Viet Cong were good at this, you know, just crude pits in the ground covered with even palm leaves, whatever, anything, a mat, camouflaged with grass and natural materials. But inside would be these sharpened punji stakes, often with dung and other infectious, you know, nasty material wiped on them, so you'd get a very nasty wound when you fell on one of them. That's all they had initially, you know, was homemade weapons. But then the North Vietnamese began to supply them with bigger and better stuff, and that's when it got really nasty. And of course, organized North Vietnamese Army troops began to move down the Cambodian border, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, into Vietnam.
These traps weren't necessarily used to kill, but just to maim.
Maim, yes. Make you die of disease, you know, from a minor wound.
You were saying earlier how you transport a lot of wounded soldiers.
Yes.
Did you transport anyone that was actually a victim of any of these traps?
No. Yep, the last one I want to remember best was a fellow with a minor foot injury being transported by helicopter, and he was shot down in a rice paddy and had to be rescued out of the rice paddy, the whole crew and the wounded guy.
So the wounded soldiers you were transporting, what was usually the cause of their wounds?
Just gunfire. Small arms fire.
Did you witness anyone that was accidentally was hit by napalm?
No.
The napalm, was that a fairly new technology for Vietnam?
I don't believe so. I think it stems all the way back to World War II, and the flamethrower used the same type of fuel. The application, I'm sure, was used in Korea. Although even though I was drafted for the Korean War, I did not make it over there because I went to Europe, so U.S. occupation forces. But weapons are terrible. But what's the difference between a bullet and a flamethrower? You know, both of them will kill. And a lot of the deaths from napalm are caused by the lack of oxygen. The fire just suddenly burns up the oxygen, especially in a closed place like a cave or something. And that again is just a weapon of war. Use it.
So that was definitely effective.
Yes, very effective.
Were you responsible for like using any of the napalm, or is that mainly?
No, it was mainly an Air Force issue, you know, or Navy, possibly.
You were talking about earlier how you had to build a camp in Vietnam. Did you have to clear out the area? Were there a lot of like traps set up for you?
Yes, we didn't have any trap problems. We were in a fairly friendly area, actually. And we're 5 miles from a very large harbor and an air base. But still, the jungle was covering the area that we needed to build tent frames in and tent pads. We had to get up out of the water because we were close to the water, 6 inches above sea level. Therefore, we had to hire native labor. And we had up to 1,000 of them with their, and you'd meet them in the morning, two of us, with their machetes and sickles. They'd work all day, and we'd pay them at the end of the day, every day, 1,000 of them.
No, you were
never worried about them, you know, chopping us up, which they could have very easily.
These were South Vietnam natives, then?
Native civilians, yes. Mostly ladies, females of all age and older men. We got no young men. I don't know where they were at, but they were very effective in clearing out the brush on the ground.
Now, these were, you were never, like, threatened by...
No, okay. Never.
You're saying how Kent State was probably a product of people funding the people who were rioting? Do you think that could have been averted?
I think it would have exposed the people funding the activity. Because there was a handful of people traveling around the country who would start these riots. They'd get the students riled up, start the riot, but before the first person was arrested or the first shot was fired, they had leave town. And these were literally professional, you know, riot inciters. And I'm sure our government knows who they are, and I think they should have been exposed and maybe even incarcerated to avoid this type of activity detrimental to fighting a war and to law and order. And a lot of young minds in a school are very impressionable, and these guys would and gals would impress upon them, you know, that they're being mistreated, you know, the anti-war thing, and they'd start a riot. And but they never stayed around to see the end. They only incited it. We should know who they are and have done something about it.
So these people actually paid for students to stay? You said they're saying.
I have a hunch that they were paid to do the job. Yes, they were well financed. They weren't doing it because of a belief in their activity. It was something that was fruitful, and they lived very well while doing it.
They had expensive cars and
stayed in nice expensive hotels. Cars, good accommodations. It just doesn't make sense that we allow that activity to go on during a war, while people are being, killed every day in a foreign country somewhere.
War protesters like Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, you think they were just helping conduct an anti-war protest? That wasn't really helpful at all. It didn't really do anything.
It definitely is not helpful, because you're supporting the enemy. You're giving moral support to an enemy that would become demoralized and probably quit and go back home if they weren't out there making a lot of noise in their favor. It's not productive in the cause of the nation, and it certainly doesn't help a soldier out there in the woods someplace.
Did your unit ever experience any of this morale loss because of the protesters?
No, not really. No.
Were you aware of it while you were in Vietnam, or was it?
I am, yes. The guy in the foxhole in the swamp, wading around in the jungle up to his waist in water, I'm sure it really rattled his brain. I was not living that uncomfortably. They used to have a cot or something to sleep on at night. It wasn't out in the water up to my ears.
So it was mostly the frontline soldiers?
Frontline soldiers that's right out there in the jungle fighting the bugs and the bullets and the mud and snakes. The biggest effect on him.
So how were you informed? How was the common soldier informed of these protests? Were they...
It was in all of our news publications. We get a lot of news publications. We didn't have TV in the boonies where we were, but it's in all the papers. Of course, it comes from papers being in magazines from home. It's disheartening, but it doesn't discourage you in what you're doing.
So, and I think anything you want to talk about?
No. I leave most of it on the other side of the water. The only thing I would like to say, though, is that the country's always enjoyed an ocean away from the battles. As near as ever got to us was Hawaii when they bombed Pearl Harbor. But the next enemy won't have that problem, They'll have a problem getting supplies over here if they want to land on our shores, but they can always drop a missile on top of us in a few minutes. And I think we need to stay alert, ready to respond to any threat of that sort. We won't have time on our side the next time.
So you think that now that the threat of war can be because of nuclear missiles, you think that now American support is much stronger? Because there's really not much threat. During Vietnam, the American public wasn't really threatened by the Viet Cong. That's
one reason they were, laid back, and the effort was just limited, very limited, never really reached the intensity it should have to end it quickly. We did it piecemeal because it was, everybody went home at night and lived a normal life. But it may not happen the next time around. I would expect an enemy to dump something on us. It could be a country as small as Iran, but there's always the big one of China, and if they team up with the Russians, it could be devastating, destroy our way of life.
If the conflict had been much closer to home, then there have been a lot fewer protests.
Yes, that our nation always been an anti-war, country. We get in only at the last minute after the threat gets very real. And the attack of Pearl Harbor got us into the World War II, very quickly. up to that point, we didn't want to really have any part of it. Stay away and not do it, give England a little support because they were going under pretty fast. But don't get involved, you know, and that sort of thing. But once it happened during World War II, there was very strong support. And there weren't many anti-war protesters in World War II. At the end of the war, it was bring the troops home. We end up dumping equipment overboard, you know, and leaving it in foreign countries to rust away. And then it turns out in Korea we needed it. The only way the Americans will fight a war is to be united against it and have some strong moral leader who will line them up and get them to soldier on, contribute to the effort.
So you definitely think that the war in Iraq and the Vietnam War should definitely be reinforced by the public and definitely supported by the public?
Neither one really received the public support it should have. The soldiers are getting much more support now than they did in the Vietnam War. But the war effort, well, we're in it, we need to win it, we need to be in it to win it, put the effort forth to do it. And a united front would make it much quicker, shorter, you know, and we'd be back home and forget about that war. But as long as the country's divided, it's going to be a mess. It'll be a half-hearted effort.
Do you think that we should just stop the war in Iraq right now just because we're not united? Do you think it's even worth fighting if we're not together?
I think it'd be very foolish to stop it right now because it'd turn the country into chaos. The country of Iraq, and I think it can be won if we keep our nose to the grindstone and get the other countries around to stay out. They can be won, and the Iraqis can have a new form of government that will work. But right now, it's pretty iffy in a very weak system over there.
Aside from the protests, How would you have conducted? I mean, do you think that the American army conducted the war efficiently as they could?
I think the army did a great job. It's just that it should have been twice the effort, twice as many troops. They could have secured all these ammo dumps that supplied the insurgencies with ammunition, bombs to make these IEDs with. We didn't have it. They tried to make it an economical thing, spend the minimum amount of money, send a minimum force in to do the job, and therefore they were spread too thin. If they sent a force in twice as strong, the war would have been over a long time ago, I do believe. It was done in the first Gulf War, very powerful force. Of course, we had more outside support too, other nations. This was started without adequate outside support.
So while you were in service, what was a typical day?
Well, like everybody, you have to have three meals a day, so we start off with breakfast. The chow was always substantial, but it wasn't gourmet. And in the field, it was the old sea rations in brown tin cans, sometimes cold. Especially if you're on the move. You had to check the reports for the day, the news, the guard report for the night, what had happened overnight. Whoever's on duty would leave you notes or brief you what happened overnight. Organize the activities for the day. And there's always lots of maintenance and that sort of thing to do. Then you spend the rest of the day inspecting troops, inspect their billets, aircraft, vehicles, order parts, or make sure that somebody is ordering the parts you need and the supplies you need to operate for the next day or week, month, depending upon the supply chain, how far away the parts are. There's always enough to do, and you're always busy. Snuffy Smith is not a good soldier. Or Beetle Bailey. we should say, Beetle Bailey, he's not the typical soldier. He is the, you always have those Beetle Baileys around, but they're not typical soldiers. Most of them are busy looking for more work, to do, doing a good job of what they're trying to do. Basically, I think the military is a very good career. It was good for me. Soldiers typically are young people right out of high school who don't know what they want to do, and it's a very good way to grow up quickly. And most of them get some real good training. They apply it well. They apply themselves well, and go on to for a a very good life. And if they decide to stay, which some do, like me, then there's a very good retirement program. There are risks involved, and there's lots of moving around. I've heard lots of criticism about the kids being moved so much, but my kids say it's only it was only good for them. You know, they just expands their understanding of more cultures, more people. They become more enlightened, really, and very down to earth. By the time they finish high school, they're really adults, and they may call them Army brats or military brats, but generally the kids say it only made their life a lot easier once they reached adulthood. They grew up quicker.
You said that you reached your highest rank after you went stateside, after the war. What was your rank during the war? Did you, how many ranks did you progress while in Vietnam?
Well, I served as a major in Vietnam, and I did not get promoted that year because that's not appropriate. You know, officers spend years in each rank, and depending on whether the Army is expanding or contracting, it can sometimes take a long time to get another rank. But it's all considered when you get the next promotion. You know, what did you do the last 5-10 years? So service in Vietnam helped me get promoted, I'm sure, because I was successful in achieving a rank of lieutenant colonel. It was more than I ever expected to reach.
President Ford at one point wanted to increase the amount of soldiers. He wanted more soldiers to go into Vietnam, but Congress denied it. Do you think that they should have sent more soldiers after North Vietnam had taken over?
North Vietnamese took over after we left, and it was too late then. I think it would have been a major problem. You know, Russia, it might have been a world war then. I think they did the right thing by not going back in. It's just that we dragged it out too long in a piecemeal fashion, and allowed it to just use up so many of our resources and soldiers that it became a waste. They probably did the right thing leaving when they did, because we allowed it to become a quagmire by not making strong, decisive moves earlier.
Do you think, you said that you think it was a good idea to leave when we did, but, or do you think it was a good idea to, you thought it was a good idea not to go back into the war after North Vietnam had taken over the entire country? Do you think it was a good idea to go into Vietnam in the first place?
Yeah, I think the reason was just in the first place, because the North Vietnamese were pulling this whole thing like Korea, of trying to stamp out the South Vietnamese and their free form of government. They wanted the whole thing. It was, again, as part of that communist expansion, we stopped it. And then we put a dent in it even today, although a lot of people suffered. A lot of South Vietnamese who are our friends suffered because we left them there. The southern part of the country is still very light, and suddenly I think the north saw the light too, and it's changed their way of governing to a more capitalistic system, you know. And all accounts of Vietnam right now, it's a booming country, and people enjoying a pretty good life, but it was a long, painful recovery from the war until the present day.
During the Tet Offensive, it was supposed to be a surprise attack because it was during the Vietnamese New Year. Was your unit surprised by this, or the...
I wasn't there at the time. And I don't think American units were totally surprised, but American soldiers are very quick to relax and not be on alert, you know. And we're fighting an enemy who will sit and watch you for a year and not make a move and suddenly pounce on you with both feet. And, of course, by 68, our troops were somewhat relaxed. And there were more of them over there, a pretty strong force. And what they did was plot this mass attack, coordinated, you know, throughout the country to try to destroy our forces. But they found out that we pounced right back and destroyed them. If you read General Giap's book, he says that South Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, were wiped out. They're no longer an effective fighting force. They were destroyed at that point.
So it was by no means
offensive.
It was by no means effective.
No means that they were no longer effective as a fighting force. They could be a little annoying, but they could not be a big force. We destroyed their effort by them exposing themselves in mass. And of course, that brought the next wave brought the North Vietnamese in even stronger.
So, do you think that the United States could have finally finished the war if it had not been for, as you said, the lack of support by the public?
I think so, yes. They would have been a successful conclusion. And even if the media had reported it properly, accurately, there would have been more support back home, and they would have stayed and won the thing completely. I'm not sure the South Vietnamese could have defended themselves once we did leave, because they were, North Vietnamese are much more determined and a very, tough fighting force, while the South Vietnamese, again, were sort of gentle, laid back, didn't want to fight.
Hey, you're saying that the media kept reporting the Tet Offensive incorrectly and saying that it was a big loss.
Absolutely.
So if the media, was the media around? Did you ever see the media up? Like in the Iraqi war now, was there a lot of coverage in your area?
Not in our area. We had very little in our area. There were some on the front lines, yes, but they tended to stay in the city and report the thing from a distance. And it was always negative. And always the bad things, not the good. Like, nobody ever reported we flew plague victims out of in the middle of the night, came into our hospital, that sort of thing, in our little medic center. There's always, the Viet Cong attack, blowing up a bar where a few American soldiers were, that sort of thing. It made the headlines.
So in that sense, you think it's a lot like
Iraq? A lot like Iraq, yes.
So why do you think the media was so biased against the United States efforts?
I'm not sure. It's just, it's a normal trend, though. The media in general, the big networks to be very biased toward the liberal view, which is, in this case was the anti-war people. Why? I don't know. They need more soldiers to become reporters, I think.